now. Great. Thank you.
Hearing the good go signal, I'm going to ask Justin Prentice, our marshal today, to call the next case for consideration.
This is case number A210061, Dante Christopher Horton versus State of Minnesota.
And good morning to everyone. We're running just a little bit behind because of ongoing technical issues, and at some point maybe Zoom will be behind us and we won't have to deal with the like of those issues. Each of you, I believe, has appeared in appellate court before. You'll have 15 minutes to make your argument in favor of your client. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. Talk in my or perhaps somewhere else on your screen. When you are ready to proceed, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of. And if you're not speaking, please mute your microphone. With that said, then we'll start with appellant counsel, Mr. Getz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Frederick Getz. I represent appellant Dante Horton. This is an appeal from an order of Hennepin County District Court Judge Paul Scoggin denying Mr. Horton's petition for post-conviction relief. And the primary issue presented by this appeal is when does a claim for post-conviction relief arise for purposes of MnSTAT 590 subdivision 4B and C. The standard for making this determination is well established. What is not clear under existing law is how is a claim defined, or in other words, what constitutes a claim? When does a party have a claim? The state and the district court take the position that as soon as a post-conviction petitioner knows any fact that may later be part of a claim for post-conviction relief, then the claim has arisen, even though that factual basis at that point is legally insufficient to obtain the post-conviction relief sought. I submit that this standard, this finding, is clearly erroneous, as under the law and guiding precedent, a claim does not arise until all facts needed to survive a motion to summarily dismiss a post-conviction petition or summarily deny a post-conviction petition have been obtained. And in this case, because it was not until May 13, 2019, when petitioner knew or should have known of all the facts needed to form the basis for his claim for post-conviction relief, his petition for post-conviction relief was timely filed because it was filed within 2 years of that date.
Mr. Getz, as I look at the statute, you started by referring to the subdivision 4C, but does not, in our review and the district court's original decision, need to focus first on whether an exception exists under the subdivision 4B. In other words, with due diligence, new evidence was otherwise not available within that 2 year period. So we don't even get to the C until the answer is clearly yes to B. Am I correct about that?
I respectfully don't know. And I can't say that it's that simple because the time limit of 4C applies to all of the exceptions within 4B, including 4B2, which is the newly discovered evidence exception. Now, 4B2 does have the requirement that I think you're referring to, Judge Slayer, that the newly discovered evidence was not reasonably ascertainable by the exercise of due diligence within the 2 year time period. And that's the 4A standard. So I think both of those timelines come into play. But I understand the court's question and focus then to be, well, if the newly discovered evidence could have been established within the 2 year time period of subdivision 4A, then that's the hard deadline that applies. But I think that still requires the and this is the open question presented by this case, is when does a claim arise for purposes of 4A? And most of the cases that interpret the claim arise requirement are the 4C cases. So while I appreciate the court's distinction, I think the court, cases on when a claim arises are equally applicable, whether it's a 4A analysis or a 4C analysis. Is that helpful?
Well, it's a difficult statute at times to read, although the Supreme Court's reported on it or ruled on it a number of times. Let me ask you, bring you back to 4B, Mr. Getz. It seems like the crux of your argument to this court and was to the trial court is that your client needed to wait to present a full case for a new trial as part of a post-conviction petition until a sister of the victim could be contacted. And then ultimately she was not or refused to take part. And by that point, the 2 years had run. My question to you is this, though. Did not the Martin case, the Supreme Court, make it clear, if it wasn't already clear prior to that, that the standard for obtaining a hearing on post-conviction relief is different and less than the standard of whether you essentially might win in the sense of getting a new trial? And so that being the case, why would the November petition affidavit that was signed by the victim not be sufficient to present to the court within the 2 years? Therefore, of course, subdivision 4B would not be satisfied because it was available by that point, certainly, and not presented to the court as part of a post-conviction petition.
Because I think it was legally insufficient to withstand a motion to summarily deny, understanding the more deferential standard that applies to even getting a hearing. But it was, in my opinion, not sufficient to get that hearing. And it's basically, if you look at the Larrison test, it would not meet the second prong of that. And I've cited the cases in my brief, but when you're talking about a witness recantation case, courts are largely skeptical to those type of claims. So you need something ultimately at the end of the day under Larrison. The second prong is without Daniel Thompson's testimony, the jury may have obtained or may have reached a different result.
And isn't that's the point? The Martin court was making the distinction is that typically trial courts are reversed because they did not presume a affidavit and evidence presented in a petition to be true, because you don't judge the credibility until you have the hearing. And there would be where the Larson test, which is still followed, would be considered in terms of credibility and certainly an attempt to subpoena, I assume, the sister as well. Although, am I correct? I'm a little confused about that because no one else saw the shooting. And if I understand correctly, there's no dispute that what she said at trial was based on what the victim told her. And now you have a victim saying what I said was incorrect. So what I'm still not even sure why that would not be enough under any scenario, at least to present to the court in November of 2018 within that 2 years. And I asked that question. I can tell from the hearing, the district court asked you the same question during the hearing, if I read it correctly.
Correct. And I think that the district court, quite frankly, underplayed the importance of Delise Thompson. She not only ran into the apartment and heard Daniel, the victim, say the defendant's name, but she also, on her own testimony, independently identified Dante Horton as being the person who only moments before the shooting went into that very apartment. So she puts him at a scene. Is she an eyewitness to the shooting itself? No, but she is an eyewitness to events that happened only moments before the shooting. And the problem, Judge Slider, is that, and you know, forgive me if I sound like a prosecutor, but if all we have is, you know, Daniel Thompson's recantation, you still have his motive, the argument at the store early. You still have his excited utterance at the scene, giving Dante Horton's name. And you still have Delise Thompson, who puts Dante Horton at the scene only moments before the shooting. That, in my opinion, you know, would likely, more than likely, have resulted in the petition not getting a hearing, even understanding the deferential standards. So the difficulty here is it's as if you're dealing with a negligence claim when you know there's been a car crash, you know there's the other drivers at fault, but you don't have causation and damages. You can't file a claim until you have that full claim. And the two cases that the appellant relies on in particular, State versus Sanchez, and also the Court of Appeals' recent decision in Edwards versus State, talk to this that when a claim arises standards quite clearly. A claim does not arise until it can withstand a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. That's the State versus Sanchez, which looked to the civil standard in the Noski versus Friedberg case involving a claim of legal malpractice. Edwards versus State, the recent decision from this court in 2020, which is under review, but it concerned a claim arises when all facts necessary to the claim are known. In that case, there was a new rule of law, and the state argued, well, the petition should have been filed within 2 years of the new rule of law. But this court ultimately disagreed because there was a second event that needed to occur, namely a court decision making that new rule of law retroactive. Once those two events had occurred, it was in 2 years of that last, the occurrence of the last event, then that's when the claim arose. So in this case, that simply did not happen until May of 2019, when the Daniel Thompson affidavit 2 was obtained addressing the Delise Thompson question. And
Mr. Getz, this, going back to the district court's order, help me understand why that the information in the second affidavit couldn't have been provided at the time of the first affidavit. And given that, why don't you go ahead and answer that question?
Yeah. No, I understand your question, Judge Cochran, and I was actually just going in that direction. Hindsight is helpful, but it's not determinative. In hindsight, if we knew in November of 2018 that Delise Thompson was unavailable and she was non-cooperative, we would have gotten the full picture as much as we could from Daniel Thompson in November 2018. But you try to get the best evidence. You try to get the best evidence. And clearly the best evidence, thinking back to the argument that we just heard, is to go out and try to get that witness interviewed and get an affidavit from that. That witness was Delise Thompson. And in November 2018, it absolutely appeared that she would be cooperative. And this is all in the record from Michael Groschen's testimony below. It wasn't until February 19, 2019, on or about the date when the two-year statute ran, that it was clear she's not going to be cooperative. She's not going to talk to you, go pound sand, that we went back to the well. So that's why, Judge Cochran, that we could not, reasonably, and the standard, quite frankly, for this, getting back to Judge Slider's initial question, through the exercise of due diligence by the petitioner or petitioner's attorney within the two-year time period. Well, I submit that that was the exercise of due diligence. Yes, in hindsight, if we would have known she was not going to be cooperative, we would have interviewed Daniel Thompson fully about Delise Thompson in November 2018. But we did exercise due diligence given those circumstances, try to obtain the best evidence. So for those reasons, Your Honor, I ask that the court, with the guidance of Sanchez and Edwards, find that the claim arose when all facts necessary to withstand the motion to summarily deny the petition were obtained, that was in May of 2019, and the district court's finding to the contrary was clearly erroneous, and therefore the district court's order denying the petition be reversed, and then the case remanded to address the remaining prongs of the newly discovered evidence exception, whether we can meet them or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Getz. We'll turn now to respondent counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm the post-conviction court because appellant's claim is time-barred. Although the post-conviction court found appellant did not file his petition within 2 years of his claim arising, this court should affirm on slightly different grounds, that appellant's claim is time-barred because the newly discovered exception does not apply. The evidence here was, in fact, discovered before the expiration of the two-year deadline, and therefore his petition was untimely. Additionally, this court could find that the new evidence exception does not apply because the newly discovered evidence would have been known before the expiration of the two-year timeline if appellant had exercised due diligence. Appellant did not act with due diligence when he learned the victim may be recanting his testimony. It was over a year before he hired counsel. Had he acted with due diligence, the newly discovered evidence could have been discovered within the 2 years. Therefore,
I have a question for you regarding due diligence, and you just, I think, noted that it was a year before he hired counsel. Should financial considerations come into play in terms of whether there was due diligence in that regard? I mean, not everyone has the resources to go out and hire an attorney right away.
Well, I do know in this instance, the record before us indicates that the family hired a private investigator. So I know obviously some action was taken. I don't think that this court probably has a record to make a finding about that. I know obviously
but is there a basis to make a finding either way, I guess is my point.
I guess the state's position would be that particular factor, his ability to hire an attorney, probably isn't legally relevant to whether or not he exercised due diligence.
Perhaps he should have brought that up with his petition. Would you say that would have been his burden?
I don't know.
I'm just wondering where I like the question that has been phrased because let's face it, we have individuals that have very limited resources.
Right. I suppose the argument could have been made under an interest of justice argument, since that particular exception to the time bar has to do with the reason for an untimely petition. And so if he was arguing, in fact, that the reason he did not file a timely petition was because of a lack of resources, I haven't looked into that in terms of if there is case law on that, but that seems to be where that
might fit. And he didn't raise it here, but I was just curious what your thoughts were. Thank you.
Ms. Vokes, can I ask you a question structurally? And Mr. Getz answered this question as well. I had, when you look at the statute, and I'm really interpreting, and I'm not sure this issue that I'm raising is directly, or it seems raised by this case has been directly answered, though it may have been indirectly answered. And that is the subdivision 4C, any petition invoking an exception must be filed within 2 years of the date the claim arises. Clearly here, appellant petitioned based on the exception. And so my question to you is, does the court and our review necessarily need to combine a consideration not only of B, although I understand that if B's not met, you don't get to C, but I don't know if my question makes sense, but it seems to me, assuming B is met, newly discovered and due diligence could not have been within 2 years, at least in this case, that would be the February of 2019, if I recall correctly. Wouldn't we need to look at the Sanchez definition the Supreme Court gave us in terms of when the claim arose? And my question about that is, regardless of the second affidavit, in any event, the November affidavit would have been clearly within the 2 years of the claim arising, which I assume you would agreed in this case didn't start, at least until orally he's told in the summer of 2017 that victims recanted. Is that how you would interpret the statute as well?
So The state's position today is certainly that we look first to see if an exception applies. And based on the exception that has been raised here, we look at those components or elements or prongs. And I think the clearest and cleanest way to resolve the case is to find that it doesn't fit that exception. I will say, I think I pointed out in my brief in a footnote that sometimes the court looks at sort of subdivision 4C time limit as sort of a threshold question. So I think it kind of depends on the case and on the facts, what sort of the cleanest way is to resolve that. But I think, and so that would be my answer, is that sometimes we just look to see if the exception, if we have met the exception and that's the answer. And sometimes the court looks first maybe to the 2-year time limit with the claim arising. Obviously, I see how these issues and questions sort of intersect here with the claim arising. And so I have two other parts to my answer. One is looking at sort of the Minnesota Supreme Court cases where they analyze a newly discovered evidence exception. They often are finding what is an objective date we can say that this petitioner knew or should have known of the evidence. And so they don't usually seem to be describing what it entails for the claim to arise and how much. Instead, if we look, for instance, at Anderson, the court found a particular date that the defendant knew of what he was claiming was newly discovered evidence. Or in Rhodes versus State, they found particular dates of a private investigator report. So they seem to be looking at, when did you find the evidence itself? And is that within the 2 years? And so in Anderson, for instance, they found that the evidence was in hand, was ascertained before the expiration of the 2-year limit, and therefore the exception did not apply. Versus Rhodes, when the evidence was in hand, these reports from a private investigator, they then found it did not, they did not file the petition within 2 years of those dates. And additionally,
can I just follow up on a point you made about when the evidence is discovered? I assume first that respondent would agree that a recantation of a victim who's the only witness essentially to the shooting is newly discovered evidence generally, but then secondly, a hearing, quote unquote, on the street or even in the jail that he's going to recant is not the evidence yet until an affidavit's obtained. So I'm assuming you would agree with that. So the earliest here by our record that evidence was discovered would be the November of 2018.
I think that's a fair interpretation of the record, is that when, that's when the evidence has been obtained. But there is something else I'd like to add about your last question, Your Honor, which is the Sanchez versus State case and what that tells us about when a claim arises. So that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court stated that it had never before decided when a claim arises for the purposes of that statute of 590.01. And what I will say is that appellant today is arguing that that Sanchez stands for the proposition that we can kind of graft this civil standard on, that the claim arises when it will survive a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. However, a close reading of Sanchez indicates that the court actually rejected that, that Sanchez essentially is rejecting sort of that what the court in B. Yang, for instance, kind of did, grafting that civil standard on. So on pages 559 to 560 in the state the Sanchez versus State opinion, the court discussed what it calls the rule of accrual, which is that the claim doesn't arise until it survives a motion to dismiss. And then the court goes on to say that this rule of accrual from, you know, the civil arena has nothing to do with the plaintiff's knowledge of his claim. And so the fact that the Noski case, which was a civil case, used that standard, they said that that has no bearing on, like, that a plaintiff's, I'm sorry, subjective awareness has no bearing on the accrual of the plaintiff's cause of action. I'm sorry, I did not answer that very clearly. But what I want to point out is that State versus Sanchez rejects the rule of accrual, so that civil standard, as something that defines when a claim arises in the post-conviction context. And instead, the court is sticking with just the objective of standard of when a claim when a defendant knew or should have known of the claim. And so that is on page 560 that the court, I think, is pretty clearly rejecting the rule of accrual from the civil arena, and that it should not be grafted onto the post-conviction statute.
Ms. Vokes, thank you for that explanation, your client's position. I wanted to pose a hypothetical, so perhaps maybe I can understand your argument a bit better in terms of interpreting the statute. Let's assume that Mr. Horton hears the same kind of in the jail cell word victim is or has recanted within a week of February of 2019. In other words, before the 2-year time period has expired, he then essentially the way it worked here, instead of waiting, though, immediately contacts family, who hires an investigator, who hires an attorney, or the hires the attorney who brings the investigator in. So by the summer of 2019, finally an affidavit's obtained that indeed he's recanting. I assume that his petition is not precluded, even though he heard it within the 2 years, but because he exercised due diligence, if we presume that was due diligence period, then we would be looking at 4C, and it's within 2 years of the claim arising, which would be that summer of the following summer. Is that, would you agree that's how you would read the statute and interpret it?
I would agree. And I think that that the piece of that would be due diligence. I mean, obviously that second prong of the statute has a number of different pieces all within that one prong. And in that case, I think the hypothetical suggests that although, you know, he heard the rumor maybe within the 2 years, that because, you know, he acted with due diligence, he could not have obtained the actual evidence, you know, within that 5-day period without, you know, because he needed to hire an attorney or a private investigator, that those things obviously do take some time. We don't expect that he'd be able to instantaneously obtain an affidavit the next day. So I think that particular hypothetical really turns on due diligence, which I think this court could find that the facts here really bring into question the due diligence as well.
That's what I was going to ask you. Isn't that really primarily the argument? And the judge really focused on it. You focused on it in your brief. The bottom line is the concept of waiting a year and then 6 months. I mean, all of that. So the focus really is perhaps less the other prongs of subdivision 4B2, because I'm assuming those are, at least for purposes of filing a petition, have been met when the one witness victim who said you shot me at trial now says he didn't shoot me. That wouldn't be cumulative. It wouldn't be impeachment. It's the whole case is whether due diligence, and that's really what we should look at as well.
I absolutely think this court should decide this case on that second prong, the whether the evidence could have been ascertained by the exercise of due diligence within the 2 years. And so in my mind, that prong, there's sort of two parts. There's the fact that the evidence was in hand, arguably in November, which is before the 2 years expired. Therefore, the exception doesn't apply. And also there's the fact that had they exercised due diligence, they could have even had that additional evidence that they wanted back in November, as I believe the question was posed to opposing counsel. And the district court made a finding that with due diligence, if due diligence had been exercised, they could have asked those same questions of the victim back in November and had sort of what Mr. Goetz perceives to be all of the evidence at that time before the expiration of the 2 years. So I think there's those two parts. There's the, you know, was the evidence in hand, and then did they exercise due diligence? I think the court could find the exceptions not met under that prong either way.
Thank you.
Anything else, Ms. Vokes?
If there's no further questions, I would certainly rely on my brief, and I would just respectfully request that this court affirm the denial of appellant's petition for post-conviction relief. As I just stated, I would urge this court to decide this case based on that second prong or element of the newly discovered exception alone, and that this evidence could have been ascertained by the exercise of due diligence, or that it was in fact obtained within those 2 years. Either way, that the newly discovered exception then does not apply. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to you then, Mr. Goetz. You're muted yet, Mr. Goetz.
Thank you. When COVID is behind us, I hope we never hear that phrase again. I will just hit the points quickly, Judge Werke. First, regarding the colloquy about indigence, there is, Judge Cochran, evidence in the transcript about Mr. Horton's indigence. I would direct the court to the post-hearing, post-conviction hearing transcript at page 19. He talks about, well, I didn't have money on myself. I had to rely upon my family. So I think that does directly go to the due diligence analysis. Second point is that I didn't hear the state emphasize it in this argument, though it seemed to suggest that the court could consider the entire due diligence or newly discovered exception, all prongs. To be clear, I think the issue before the court is limited just to the timeliness issue, so that the case rises or falls on that one if issue. Lastly, two final points. I think that really, as I see it, it's a case of, to some extent, first impression on this. If we're asking the court to do is consider how do we interpret the phrase or the word evidence within the newly discovered evidence section of 4B2 in the context of the entire statute 590.01, because it's the discovery, you know, can the evidence be discovered with reasonable diligence within the 2-year time period? Well, what does evidence mean? If you look to the entire statute, other than that newly discovered evidence exception, the statute talks about a claim. And when you look at 590.01 subdivision 4C, the petition has to be brought within 2 years of the date that the claim arises. So it's my position that interpreting the statute as a whole, one has to interpret the word evidence in light of the entire statute, which is based upon claims. And just having some evidence is insufficient. You need all of the evidence that would be sufficient to withstand, to create a claim. And I think this is absolutely contrary to the state's last argument. This is absolutely supported by the Sanchez case. I disagree with the state's argument that Sanchez rejected the accrual rule. I disagree with that. I would direct the court specifically to pages 559 and 560, in particular footnote 8 of the Sanchez opinion, when there's extensive discussion about the accrual rule. Now, the only thing that Sanchez did is reject the argument that the accrual rule had a subjective piece to it. It doesn't. It's an objective test. Whether it's civil, criminal, it's objective. When does a party know or should have known of the elements necessary to a claim? And in terms of elements necessary to a claim, under, you know, Noski and the other cases cited and relied upon, one does not have a claim until you have all of the facts necessary to meet all elements of that claim. And that was reaffirmed by this court's, implicitly reaffirmed by this court's recent decision in the Edwards case. It's not until you have evidence of all events necessary to bring a claim that you have a claim. And that's when the statute starts to run. So I would ask the court to reverse and remand for further proceedings on the post-conviction petition. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well briefed and well argued. It does assist us in our decision-making today. Matters are under advisement and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe.